One of our members, Joel Strom, recommended our speaker today, and I had the pleasure of listening to his presentation of the CFA Society. And Joel introduced him to the CFA Society, and I loved the introduction, and I said, I can't improve on it. So with courtesy of Joel's introduction, I'll introduce our speaker, Nick Sargent. And I did get permission from Joel to give the presentation and his introduction. Nick Sargent brings to us a rich background of economic economies and leading institutional investment manager. Nick's resume includes working at many leading American institutions, including the U.S. Treasury, the Federal Reserve, J.P. Morgan, Salomon Brothers, Prudential Insurance, and most recently, Fort Washington and Investment Advisors, where he served as Chief Investment Officer and now as Chief Economist. He has a doctorate in economics from Stanford, an undergraduate from Berkeley. Nick's approach to investment markets is grounded in economic fundamentals and unraveling the intricacies of interest rates, credits, and business cycles. He recently completed and published a booklet, which I have the pleasure of reading, Global Shocks, which describes some of the major financial crisis of the last two decades, and the full title of it, Global Shocks, an Investment Guide for Turbulent Markets. Nick spends more and more of his time in Charlottesville, although he's been in about seven states in the last 3 weeks and is going to San Diego shortly after this presentation. He now lives in Keswick in a house that he built 5 years ago. He's published articles in the CFA Institute magazine and teaches seminars at Darden. One of his philanthropic interests is promoting financial literacy in urban schools. Without further introduction, let me introduce Nick Sargent. Nick?
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich, and to the senior statesman of Virginia. It is a pleasure to be here. I'm actually, as you could tell, originally from the West, survived 25 years on Wall Street, and actually then moved to the Midwest, Cincinnati, before coming to Keswick and Charlottesville. And I guess I'd say in the beginning, I'm not as dumb as I look. The first time I was in Charlottesville, I said to the person who brought me, who's from the area, I said, when are you going to get me a job here in the business school? And so that was in 1987. I came and did a presentation at Keswick when I was with J.P. Morgan at the hall. And it was in the evening. It was nice. But it was when I pulled back the curtains, and it was about a year, at this time of the year, I said, this is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And so my wife and I did some teaching at Darden as an electives, and we fell in love, and here we are. So that's the background. What I want to do is then what's, the topic for today. And basically, the roots go back 1 year to the election. And I don't know how you people feel. I'm not a partisan one way. I'm one of the rare people who would consider himself independent, who can be persuaded by arguments. I don't think the number of people in that category is shrinking. But I'm a believer that in America we need an educated electorate. And I quite frankly felt after the campaign last year, stop the debates. They're a farce. I mean, they're not about issues. They're about mudslinging and making things up. So I was frustrated. And then I said, what can you do about it? And I said, I don't know. But my background is, and my first love when I took economics was really public policy issues. And I said, I'm going to go back to my love for public policy issues. And then basically this new book that I'm drafting is what are the key public policy issues that we're going to be facing, let's say, in the next few years? And many of them surfaced in the 2016 election. But as I thought about them, many of them have been around for a very long period of time. And so as I've written the book, and I pretty much have a draft of it done now, basically what I am doing is taking issues. And it could be, why is healthcare so complex? Or do we need tax cuts or do we need tax reform? Is free trade a good thing or is it suddenly a bad thing? These are issues that have been around a long time. And so what I'm trying to do is explain how the issues have evolved, then try to draw. I'm tired of everybody having an opinion. I want to go and say, what are the expert studies in the field telling us so that we can make informed decisions? And then lastly, if there are differences between Republicans and Democrats, I'll try to point out what those differences are, but it's not in a finger pointing. It's just be aware of it. And then everybody here, you go make up your own minds. I'm not here to be a proselytizer. I will have felt I did my job. So what I want to do then take you through, there's about 8 topics covered in the book, way too many. So I tried to hone it in. My friend Joel Strout was helpful in telling me what he thought you people would be most interested in. So I've kind of tailored it around what I think are the key issues that may be on your mind. But we're going to have time for Q&A, and if I've missed something, please feel free to chime in. So now, just to advance. Okay. So that's where we go. So, believe it or not, it's 1 year since the election, and this wasn't just a run-of-the-mill election. The question was it an extreme makeover election? Because, what do we know about our president? Nobody's going to say he's shy and bashful. And he came in and he wants to completely revamp basically economic policies, foreign policies and the like. So extraordinarily ambitious candidate to emerge, and nobody really gave him much of a chance of winning. The odds on election day were maybe 30-35% chance. And so, I always ask myself the question, what if Hillary had won? Because I was supposed to be, what will be the impact of the election on our financial markets? And what I figured out, I had to write something almost at the same time, but I knew I was going to be driving to Charlottesville. I go, I'm going to have to write this before the election. So I go, okay, Hillary is going to win narrowly, but the Republicans keep control of both houses of Congress, so nothing's going to happen. It's going to be gridlock. Well, then when I realize, wait a minute, it's a Republican sweep. Gridlock is dead, we thought. Now what do you say? And so the one lucky break I got is I'm a member of the Economic Club of New York, and Donald Trump in September gave a speech. Usually I don't go and listen because they're canned speeches. I got a lucky break. The teleprompter wasn't working. So he couldn't do the script. He had to say what he believed. And it was interesting. There were times where I said, oh, this is the part of the speech that the Heritage Foundation wrote for him on tax policy. But when you get to trade issues, he believes this, and it came through, and his constituents are people who lost their jobs in manufacturing, etc. So that was helpful for me to try to understand what he really believed versus what he was just throwing out there. So the next question was, what was going to be the impact on financial markets? Well, the initial assessment was, oh my God, the markets are going to tank because, he's not a politician. He doesn't have a clear agenda, et cetera. And, that happened for a few hours. And they made one, I think it's the only conciliatory speech that he's given. And lo and behold, the markets go, oh, phew, he's not going to be as extreme as we feared. And the markets began to take off. And they really haven't stopped. So I gave a talk in Cincinnati at the beginning of the year, and it was entitled, Will Trump's Election Be a Game Changer? And I can either say for the economy, and my argument is going to be, no, he's not a game changer for the economy. But what is he a game changer for the markets? And you have to say, so far, what I'm simply trying to show you is what investment results look like in 2016 from January to Election Day, and what they look like from Election Day. I did it as the end of the third quarter. And there, you know, people talk about animal spirits being unleashed. There's no denying. Look at stock market returns, S&P up 20%. Russell 2000, 26%. If I go to bond market, high yield bonds up almost 9% returns. So the bottom line is that the financial markets sat there and said, rightly or wrongly, this guy is kind of a pro-business candidate. He's going to be good for business. Whatever you think of his policies, he's pro-business. That's all I need to know. He believes in tax cuts. He believes in deregulation. And away we go. So that's been kind of the conventional view of the rally in the stock market. And I think there's some truth to that. The one point, though, I want to make, and it's going to come back later, is Trump can't explain it all. And I look, what is IFA? IFA is the international equity markets. Gosh, they're up even more than the U.S. stock market. Part of it is that the dollar weakened. But basically, globally, it's been a period where all world markets are doing well. Then the MSCI, that's emerging markets. So same thing for emerging markets. So my bottom line is, something has happened in 2017 to cause a lot of people to be more optimistic about future prospects. So in the U.S., it often gets tied to the Trump election. What I contend is there's something broader than the Trump election. I contend that the most important development this year that very few people anticipated is virtually every economy in the world is seeing an improving pattern this year. And what with that, and I mean, we saw it in Europe is having its best growth since 2010. Japan is having its best growth and market performance in decades. China has stabilized. Emerging markets are doing better. So view what is happening as part of a global phenomena. And I'll come back to this theme at the end of the presentation. Okay, so let's see. I do not know why it's not advancing. I don't know if I did something. Do you? Yeah, it looks like it's, I don't know. Okay, all right. So that's the backdrop. Now what I want to do, though, is, okay, so we have this surprise election. We have this very favorable market response. But what are the issues that I think we should all be discussing amongst ourselves? And these aren't just for 2017, 2018. I think these are issues that are going to be around for quite a while. So first and foremost, I'm going to say our economy and many foreign economies are being challenged to grow faster. And guess what? Everybody in this room, including yours truly, is part of the challenge. As our population is aging, baby boomers increasingly retire, we live longer. Basically, what I'm going to say is the aging of the population is putting more burden on the federal government in terms of the cost of entitlement programs. And so that is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And I'm going to go over that with you. So this is the tsunami that is going to be unfolding. It's already beginning, but it's going to intensify in the coming decade. So now the challenge, as I say, I'm going to come back to the, to the extent there was an economic issue that helped get Trump elected and the GOP elected, what was the issue? The basic argument that they were making is this economy has experienced a very lackluster recovery from the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And so what they're trying to say is we're going to overhaul economic policies, and in particular tax and regulatory policies, to reinvigorate the economy. The message is somewhat similar to Ronald Reagan's message when he was elected in the early 1980s. Get government off my back, put resources back in the private sector, and we're going to see a renewed dynamism. So one of the policies to get us there is partly less government involvement in the economy in terms of regulations, but the other is certainly tax cuts, tax reform, which is what the House and Senate is working on right now. And so one of the questions that I'm going to get into is, first, do we understand the difference between tax cuts, which are intended to be stimulative, or tax reform, which is not intended to add to the budget deficit, but to make the tax system more equitable and more efficient? And what I'm basically going to be arguing is, in my view, this is not the time for major tax cuts. The economy's 4% unemployment rate. I want to stimulate it now? Don't I risk overheating? I am going to argue there's a case for tax reform because the corporate tax sector is not as efficient in terms of tax rates. It has a much higher tax rate in the U.S. than our competition. And the key thing is then, can we modify the tax code in a way that will encourage greater productivity? And then I'm going to go to global issues, the trade issues and globalization. And what is their impact on jobs? What is their impact on income inequality, and what do we do about it? And then lastly, I'll come back to investment portfolios. So that's the roadmap. Okay, let me take on the first issue. I'm going to try to do it quickly. What's wrong with the U.S. economy? Because I would say this is the principal argument of Donald Trump and the GOP, is this economy isn't the old economy we used to know that grew at a trend rate in most of my lifetime, the post-war period, I'd say 3% plus real growth. What we've been able to do for the last 10 years is 2%. It doesn't sound like a big difference. It is. So the question is then, why isn't our economy growing on the old trend? What's happened? And basically, we had a little bit of a discussion in our luncheon. The bottom line is economists don't agree. Surprise, surprise. What I've learned is, by the way, I studied both microeconomics, that's where you look at the industry level, and I still think most of what I learned is valid. Macroeconomics, most of the things I learned, I go to professors today and I say, I don't know what you teach your students. Everything I was taught isn't working. So we're, I think, truly in the profession at a period where we're struggling to come up with answers. But what I want to do, though, is just quickly say, I think there's four views out there about why the economy is hurting or not growing as rapidly. The first I call the debt hangover argument. What is the argument? The argument is, how did we get into the financial crisis? And the argument is people took on too much debt, particularly households. And in many instances, an example is what Rich worked on, subprime mortgages. These are people who took debt that really didn't have the capability to repay it or service it. Okay, so you get in over your skis in debt, and the same is true for many corporations. So one of the academic findings that look at debt crises are these aren't garden variety recessions. I mean, remember in the good old days of the 80s, inflation would be high, interest rates would be up, the car manufacturers would have to furlough workers and say, hey, take the summer off until demand comes back and we bring you back. Those days are gone. This is a situation where there was just too much debt being taken on. You can't turn on a dime. It takes a period. And the conclusion of the historical studies is it takes about 10 years to work off the debt excess. So what I like about this thesis is I said to you, something's happening in 2017. And part of my argument is that I believe what's happening is after periods of subpar growth, not just in the U.S., but around the world, we're finally getting over the hump of the debt overhang. So that's thesis one. Thesis two, secular stagnation, just a sophisticated term. What is it really focusing on? It's saying, okay, if we look at the U.S. economy and say, where's the area that isn't performing as we would have expected? It's business investment. In other words, you, the consumer, for a while people said, oh, people can't spend like they used to. Well, that was true for a while, but honestly, people are spending again. I'm not worried about that. The real issue that economists agree on is businesses are hiring, unemployment rates down to 4, but they're not spending on plant and equipment and research. And that is the key to improving labor productivity. So the secular stagnation thesis that Larry Summers is a leading advocate of says, well, what do we got to do? Well, the problem is, even though interest rates are very low, they're still too high. We need faster inflation. Okay, that's his argument. Don't listen to him. I'm sorry. He's a smart guy, but doesn't make any sense to me. Let's go to supply-side constraints. There's another prominent economist, Robert Gordon, Northwestern University, one of the leading experts on productivity. He's the pessimist because he's saying, you guys, you're saying we have a demand problem. We don't. The reason we're growing slower is twofold. One, our labor force isn't growing like it used to because of population growth. Participation rates aren't what they used to. And, oh, yes, by the way, we don't like immigration anymore because we, in the past, if U.S. workers weren't expanding that fast, well, let's bring in more from abroad. We don't do that anymore. But then the second argument he makes is that the slowdown in productivity that I'm going to show you is not cyclical. It's just inherent. And so basically what he's saying is, heck, I think that the economy's new trend rate isn't 3 or 2. It's 1.5. So he's the pessimist. The last view is that part of the problem is governments become too burdensome, too many regulations, policies have become too erratic, and what we simply need is less government interference in the economy. And I cite John Taylor at Stanford, who was one of the people in the running for Fed chair, as having written a book on this. And by and large, I would say, you know, now we go and say, okay, here's the 4 hypotheses. The real question is, now, what does President Trump and the Republicans in Congress, what do they believe? So they're clearly in the latter category, that get government off our backs and the like. So the key that they're saying is we've got to have tax policy changes. And in particular, and I'm going to come back to this later, there's policy changes for businesses and there's policy changes for individuals. Really, the heart, I believe, of the Republican House bill that was drafted a year ago by Paul Ryan and the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee was the emphasis was changing the tax code for corporations so that they would do more investing at home, less investing outside the United States. So that's what they believe. But when I come to taxes, again, there is a big, big difference between our president and the Republicans in Congress. President Trump really wants bigger is better, just more. Give people more. And, you know, he's, you know, somebody says, oh, the tax cuts for the individuals, they're going to favor the rich, the poor. I mean, maybe, but it's hard for me as I read this bill. I honestly just think the guy says, we have an economy that's operating subpar. Just give more money to people, and that'll take care of the problem. Again, my argument is terrible timing, Mr. President. You could have done this 10 years ago. You don't do this now. And so what I am saying is that there's a tension between the congressional Republicans who don't want to have a give it all away versus the president. That's why we're going to see how it plays out. And I'm arguing, which may be controversial, but I'm arguing that if it was Nick Sargent setting policy, I'd make the tax changes for the corporations. I believe in simplifying the individual tax code. I'm in favor of that. But I'm not in favor of let's have major cuts at this time. And then, you know, again, ultimately, investors are going to have to decide or can decide which set of policies makes sense. Okay, so this is the backdrop. Now, what I want to come to is the issue that really wasn't debated in the election. You know, most of my career, if you said, okay, there's an election between Republicans and Democrats, in the good old days, the Democrats were, let's not worry about the budget deficit, let's help to stimulate the economy. The Republicans were the conservative party that says, no, 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 you can't keep spending more than the revenues you're generating. So that used to be. When Ronald Reagan got elected, he said, throw out the playbook. We're going for growth. People who worry about the budget deficit are just a bunch of fuddy-duddies. That's old-style thinking. So for a while, the truth of the matter was, during the Reagan years, we had record budget deficits, and it didn't hurt us. And so therefore, a lot of people today believe, you know, why are you suddenly concerned? And so my reason for being concerned is these are projections of the Congressional Budget Office about where we're headed on the budget deficit over the next 10 years, if there's no change in policy. So you can say, well, who's the Congressional Budget Office? And the answer is, they're not Republicans, they're not Democrats, they're technicians. They're people trying to give as fair a portrayal. You can say, are they always right? Maybe they're too pessimistic, possibly. But at the same time, my fear is that when I listen to the administration, and including our Secretary of the Treasury, well, okay, now you want to have all these tax cuts. How are you going to pay for them? Growth. Folks, that is called assuming the problem away. It's nonsense. Okay. The point is, it's okay to say there may be a stimulative impact, but there's going to be a budgetary consequence. Don't believe anybody who says growth will solve the problem. It's not the case. So now, though, the question is, you can say, well, why does this budget situation start to spiral out of control? And here's where I come back and say, because more people are joining our ranks. The good news for Rich is that, you know, membership in the Senior Statesmen of Virginia, I project, is going to, you know, double, triple. We're all, you know, as more and more people get smart enough to join our crowd. So it's the aging, it's two things. The baby boomers retiring, but the second component is I mean, remember the old joke when, people would retire, you give them the gold watch, and then, okay, 1 or 2 years later, they've moved on to a better place. No, today, people are living longer. And you combine more people and more people living longer, and that puts a strain on our entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and oh yeah, by the way, we do have to pay interest on our borrowings, and that keeps going up as we get deeper and deeper into debt. Okay, so you can say, okay, that's a forecast. Some people say, oh, I don't believe it. I'm saying, I don't know if those numbers are going to be exactly correct, but the direction I'm convinced is correct. So now, what's the other part that you have to know? This is, if you remember one chart from any presentation, I commit this to memory. I just fear that at night you may not sleep well because it's so scary. But here's what it is. Okay, I'm dividing the federal budget spending into two lumps. Discretionary spending. No, you have a choice. What are you paying for? Defense, education, environment. These are probably among the biggest items in the budget that you would consider to be discretionary. Oh, maybe infrastructure programs? Okay. What's mandatory? Mandatory are, the federal government has made a commitment, and so that commitment is to honor its commitment on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and paying the interest on the debt. So when these programs, that is everything but Social Security, of course, is the 1930s, but when the other entitlement programs got created, it was in Johnson's Great Society in the 60s. Okay, what was mandatory outlays? Well, they were 30% of the budget, and discretionary was 70. Where are we today? If you go beyond, look at 2017, we just flip-flopped. Today, 70% of federal government outlays are mandated by entitlement programs. 30% are truly discretionary. So what does this pose for you as a problem today? When the president and OMB submitted their initial budget, they go, well, we got to try to make the numbers add up. But if we want these cuts and everything, okay, what we're going to do is we want defense spending to increase, I don't know if it was 9% or 7 to 9%. They haven't talked much about public works, infrastructure spending. But then what they did is they slashed every single social program in the budget over which you have discretion. And, of course, the Democrats said, you can't do this. Okay, it's a non-starter. But that's the type of choices you get to make. Well, so if you think it's tough now, roll the tape forward. Give me 10 or 15 years now. I may not be around, so you can't hold me accountable. But the projections of the CBO is 10, 15 years from now, if we stay on this course, every dollar of revenue the government collects will go to fund entitlement programs. So if you want defense, if you want education, if you want the environment, if you want infrastructure, you have to finance all of that by borrowing more and more and more and more and more. So this is where I come, and I have some here, you're going to find some issues. I have sympathy with Republicans, some issues with Democrats. This is one area where I actually have sympathy with Paul Ryan. I mean, basically, he's saying this game can't continue. We can't keep postponing the day of reckoning. You could in the Reagan era. The retirement of the baby boomers were 30 years away. It's happening as we speak. So the question, now is, can we have a discussion of entitlement programs? Now, if I was running as your congressman and said, let's talk about it, I would probably you know, I would not have a prayer's chance. But I'm not, so I can talk about it, whereas the politicians can't. Okay, so let's see. I think we have another freeze. I don't know what I did. Okay, so what did you
just
do?
Wake it up. Blue.
Oh, the blue? Okay.
It's asleep.
Okay. Okay. Uh-oh. See, this, remember I didn't want you to forget this chart? This is the computer. All right, well, I don't know. If not, I'm going to continue. Oh, that's too bad. What do you think? Well, he's trying to fix it. Let me go and say, okay. Oh, there you go. Perfect. Okay, thank you so much. Basically, okay, I've got three programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. My argument is Social Security we can fix. I'm not concerned. We've fixed it several times. Think of it. When you created Social Security in the 30s, probably the average life expectancy of an American male was in the mid-60s. And so you didn't have this problem of longevity. But as we realized, past decades, wait a minute, people are living longer. What they did was for new enrollees, I'm not talking about existing recipients, for new enrollees, the age at which you're eligible for full benefit, we're going to shove it back another 6 months. They just keep pushing it back. And what I'm basically saying is it's a simple solution, but it works. It's still, there's a little bit of political dynamics to it, but that's okay. I want to come, though, to what I think is health care. Okay, even our president has said, after he said, oh, this is a cinch, just elect me, we'll take care of it, done. And then nobody knew how complex healthcare was. What? You know? So the point is, he's right on that. So what I'm trying to do is make two points for you about why we need healthcare reform. First, our system is on average twice as expensive as any other system in any other advanced economy. So here's, you know, just the data. These were as of 2013, but I've updated it to 2015. Story's the same. But in 2013, when we last had the data, we were spending 17% of our economy on healthcare versus a median for the other 16 major economies, 10%. Okay, you can look per capita, you can look it out of POS. And then, you know, so the bottom line is we're paying twice as much. You wouldn't mind if you said, well, we're getting superior medical services. But we're not. We're getting about the same. And again, you can measure it various ways. One is life expectancy. So our life expectancy is about the same. And then, but the thing is, you know, we're going to get into the question then, well, what's causing costs to be out of control? I thought this was interesting. In the United States, the average spend per discharge, $21K, versus you go to other advanced economies, $2,000 to $14K. So our hospitals are a lot more expensive. But let's go technology, because most people believe that the U.S., okay, maybe we're costly, but you know what? We've got better technology. Well, that's true. So we're just looking at how many MRIs doctors routinely assign, you know, and for 1,000 population in the United States, 107 versus much lower number. So basically, here our doctors are trained. We don't know what's wrong with you. Shoot them into the room, or we're going to get, you know, but those are expensive. So this is some of the factors. But just to, again, give you, this is the pattern we're on. So the blue is consumer price index for all urban consumers for medical care going back to the launch of Medicare, Medicaid. And the other is what our overall consumer price index is, and then I also did how fast are wages going up. So that is not sustainable. So the question that I get to in the book a little bit is, let's come to the health care issue and why it's so contentious. And there's two parts of it. I think the Democrats throughout, whether it goes back to LBJ, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Obama, are believers that it is our responsibility to provide health care insurance coverage for all people. I mean, that's a moral obligation we have. And, you know, whether you agree with it or you just don't, that's the thing. Okay, the next question, though, I don't have a problem with that. I just ask another question. Okay, we all agree with that. Can I count on you to pay for that? And that's where you get, wait a minute, no, I think everybody should have it. Just tax the rich. Well, they've looked at studies. No, folks, if it was that easy, we would have done it. No, these are, ask yourself, are you willing to pay for your next door neighbor's health care? You know, I mean, that's the basic dilemma that we're facing. So what I try to do in the book is, because I didn't know the answer, I'm trying to figure it out. How can we not figure this? Well, what I learned is we've tried and tried and tried. In the 70s, under the Nixon administration, we came up with the concept of HMOs, health maintenance organizations. So this was going to be cheaper because no longer do you go to Marcus Welby, MD, and he bills you for his services. Now you go to Kaiser and you pay for bundled services, and that's supposed to be cheaper. Well, it was until it wasn't. And then with Hillary, Hillary came up with universal health care, except her, I mean, her, Hillary is a policy, she is the anti-Donald Trump. Donald Trump doesn't know a policy issue if his life depended on it. Hillary knows every detail. And so the problem is, though, she's got rules and regulations this thick. And so even the Democrats said, we don't want that. So then the Republicans said, well, guess what? We don't want universal. We want private exchanges. And then in the end, Hillary Care went away. It was, the Dems didn't even do it, so they dropped the proposal. Well, guess what? Obama resurrects the idea of private exchanges. But now you've got the Republicans. Oh, my God, he's mandating it. And I'm being a little bit facetious, but I'm saying it's tongue-in-cheek. There's politics going on. And what I'm simply trying to say is, in this case, in the case of exchanges, and I've read sensible people, you can make them work. Maybe Obamacare has some flaws. But what I'm basically saying is, the thing I didn't realize is what the Republicans, if you go to Paul Ryan and you go, are you really dead set to kill the exchanges? And if you gave him truth serum, I think the answer is no. What the Republicans said is Obama pulled a fast one on us, because what he did was he changed the definition of who's eligible for Medicaid. So the low, you know, the people that are supposed to be the poor that can't supply it, they changed the definition. So now you're eligible if you're at 140% of the poverty line instead of the poverty line. So we're just changing who's eligible, but making a lot more people eligible. So you say, well, so what? Well, the so what is that little change costs American taxpayers $1 trillion over 10 years. And so what part of the Republican, the Republicans can't be that upfront and honest with you. But that's what some of the wrangling is really all about, is they're trying to figure out ways to take away from an entitlement program. So the old rule on entitlement programs is they're growing too fast, but once you commit to one, it's political suicide to take it away. So what I'm basically saying is, so we're doing kind of theatrics, But that's basically what the issue is about. So finally, though, is the debate over health care reform just Republicans versus Democrats? No. I read two books, one by Republican-leaning, one by Democrat-leaning health care expert. Both come to the same conclusion. It's that there's five main constituencies in healthcare. You got the doctors, you got the hospitals, you got the insurance providers, you got the employers. I'm forgetting the last one. What?
Patients.
Yeah. And guess what? They don't agree. So what makes healthcare so tough is that the major players don't agree, and that's why we're kind of stuck. Okay, so I'm going to move on. Now I want to just, I'm watching my clock, probably going, am I going over too long or not? Just, okay, I'm going to try to make this fast then. Okay, so let me just go and say on trade issues, which I said that the president feels very strongly about. What have I found? I'm going to just cut to the chase. Here's my story, is he said, NAFTA and the TPP and all this are the worst deals ever negotiated in history. And they've cost Americans jobs, okay? Mr. President, I'd like to take a look at this chart, if you will, if I may. Okay, where did we lose some manufacturing jobs? Well, in the Reagan years when we had a super strong dollar. And then you'll notice most of the 80s, 90s, there's no net job losses in manufacturing. There is net job losses in the decade of the 2000s. And what basically happened? You had China comes into the World Trade Organization and many other Asian economies. Did they kind of cheat to keep their currencies unduly cheap? Yes, they did that then. So there is some basis for criticism, and do we need to do something about that issue? And the answer is yes. But I'm basically saying that we do not. You know, if you said to me, I started off and said this market has done phenomenally well, what would cause me to be bearish? I'm skipping over. The market's done very well. Look at corporate profits. When the stock market fell 50%, corporate profits fell 50%. Since then, corporate profits were on a roll. They faded, and that was when the market got antsy, but they started to come back. So my bottom line is that I believe strong corporate profits plus still very moderate interest rates are helping to keep this market relatively strong. If you said, what do I worry about? If I thought we were going to get into a trade war with China, I start selling, because that's not going to be good for the global economy. So lastly, you know, just on the investment side, if you could go back and say, try to remember what you were thinking in 2008, 2009. It was scary. I mean, it was, I said I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime, that the financial system on the brink of collapse. Could we go into a Great Depression? Well, we didn't. But, you know, if you said now, okay, if you had an investment, your retirement portfolio or your investment portfolio, what should you have been doing these last 9 years? Answer, take as much risk as you can. Be in the stock market. Be in junk bonds. Those have outperformed. Okay. Now, will I tell you, load up the plate now? No. I mean, we've had a huge run. I personally feel we're very overdue for a pullback. Does that mean it's a bear market? 20, 25%? Not necessarily. So I'm just cautious now. But, you know, my bottom line at the end of the day is then that you have other people who are happy days are here again, and I'm going, hold on, hold on. Those returns that I showed you, we're not going to replicate them. So basically, if you say, Nick, do you buy equities? Do you sell equities? Do you hold equities? I'm in the hold camp right now. So I haven't unloaded them, but I'm not adding to it. And I'll stop there, Rich.
That's fantastic. Let me ask you a question.
me open it up for questions, and there'll be a microphone on each side. Jim's got one on that side, and John's got one. And wait for the microphone to come to you, because this is a podcast, and the folks that are listening to the podcast won't be able to hear you unless you have a microphone. So let me open it for questions.
I could get the advertisement for my book.
Oh, yes. This is the book I was referencing. Nick's got a new one coming out in the next couple of
years. This is the old one.
The one that I talked about. Yeah. Questions?
Uh-oh. Yes.
Please.
What sort of tax configuration would you see as a good element for the economy and for the deficit?
Okay. Excellent. So what I was alluding to was 1 year ago when, okay, I know now I've got a president, Republican, and I've got the Republicans in charge. I go and say, have they drafted anything that I can study? So the answer is yes. The House Republican Committee, and it was really Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady, have been working for 6 years on tax reform. And, okay, the essence of what their reform was, is, I call it reform, what they're basically saying is, you know, nobody likes U.S. companies outsourcing workers, you know, abroad. Why don't they just keep the money at home? And even the Obama administration faced it. And so the answer is pretty simple. President Obama, you're taxing U.S. corporations at a 35% rate, and if we include state taxes, it's up to 39% if you paid it, you know. Okay. That's now much higher than almost any other advanced economy. So you're a businessman, and I'd rather, you know, be in a low tax area of the world. Okay. So basically, the idea of the House proposal was, we're going to lower the House, the marginal rate to 20%, which is what they're talking about today. But what the Republicans in Congress said is, okay, but we don't, again, I said there's no free lunch. If I do this, I don't get as much revenue. How do I offset that loss of revenues? Well, I've got to take some things away, because they're also giving businesses immediate deduction on depreciation. So what they basically said is, okay, what we're going to do is you used to be able to deduct the interest payment on your borrowings. You can't do that anymore, because we've given you these other breaks. And the other thing they did is they came up with something that was very controversial called a border adjustment tax. In a nutshell, it was basically subsidizing U.S. exporters but taxing U.S. importers. So if you're Walmart, you're going to pay a much steeper tax because of your imports. I knew that wasn't going to fly. Okay. So that was worth, though, $1 trillion in potential revenue. So then they had to come up with other things. But what I'm basically saying is the original plan of the House Republicans was, we don't want to add to the budget deficit. And so what I'm basically saying is, now roll the tape forward to today. The president says, well, I want to give away money to a lot of people and this sort of thing. So right now, the increase in the budget deficit projected from the new tax bill being considered by the House will add $1.5 trillion on top of what I was showing you before. So this is why I was trying to make the statement. I think it's crazy to do major tax cut, increase the budget deficit, when I've got unemployment at 4%. If it was at 8, 10, maybe. But I think the timing is terrible for that. And so I would have preferred the original bill to the bill that's now under consideration.
You made a comment a few moments ago about the lack of manufacturing renewal, if you will, of renovation, which is part of the reason we don't have the steel industry anymore.
Yes.
Where do you see a difference between that and and the lack of taking care of our infrastructure that the government normally takes care of.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
And how that factors into the
Very good. So what I would say, to be clear, again, under the, you know, when Trump got elected, I actually thought that made sense to me is, okay, we do want to put more blue-collar workers to work. Let's put them to work on rebuilding American infrastructure, right? That made a lot more sense to me than I've got coal miners in West Virginia, and this industry that has been on the decline for a century, you know, I'm going to turn it around. So I am a proponent for, you know, more on the infrastructure side. The problem is, again, we come to, we've got a budget constraint, and so when they're trying to get up all the numbers, they can't make the numbers add up, even if they don't put infrastructure as a potential category. So that's why it's just kind of been forgotten. The last thing that I didn't touch on is, because I think this is important too, you know, I just think there's too much finger pointing at what's the cause of the problem. And I'm trying to say the problem of trade is, I still see benefit. I'm a believer in free trade, and I think we've done well with it. But when people come to me and say, yeah, but we're losing jobs in manufacturing, I'm saying, do you see a pattern here? Every major industrial economy is. And I would argue it's part of the development process. For example, what if I said, let's go back to farming? No, you know, we are more efficient today in farming than anybody else. That's progress. But over time, we sent people to manufacturing, now to services. I truly believe, if it's me, if you elect me as your next leader, I want to educate our people for jobs in the technology space and the like. And so, you know, again, you go, here's every major industrial economy. If you said to me, who has done the best job of dealing with disruption in manufacturing technology, hands down, it's Germany. And Germany, though, has an extensive program where the government is involved in jobs training. So in other words, you got college, but then you've got training of job skills. And you're not leaving it to the employer, because the employer says, well, wait a minute, I train these guys, and then just when they get good, they leave me. So Germany's developed the system of job training skills that services their economy. So that's, to me, an interesting course. But it's not, you know, again, I don't pretend it's an easy, I can't just go and say, okay, we just want to be Germany. And no, it's a lot tougher than that. But I share the, you know, I wish we would work on infrastructure, but it means you've got to give up something else.
Who did you leave off this chart? Somebody. There's 7 billion people in this world. Who is increasing their manufacturing?
Who's in? The answer is emerging, well, China emerging. And emerging economies. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm glad, this is a good audience. The reason is there are parts that I threw out of the talk because I ran out of time, so you're giving me time to put it back in. The part I didn't get to was globalization. And really, most of my career, I've been in international. I studied international economics, and I was always, you've got to understand the global economy, blah, 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 blah. Okay. So now the question that Michael Spence, he's a Nobel laureate, he was at Harvard, he wrote a great article in Foreign Affairs in 2007, and the issue is, why have we gone from thinking globalization is good to not so good? And his argument was very simple. His argument was, up until the 2000 period, globalization was really getting a lot of these emerging economies to perform better. And they were suppliers of raw materials to the industrialized economies. So everybody's happy if they're doing well as your supplier, you know, that's good for you. What he's basically saying, and you mentioned China is one, but it's broader than China. It's other Asian economies and other parts of the world. As they rose up the food chain and start competing directly with us in manufacturing, now, if you're a worker, I don't like that. I'm facing this competition. So, so this is the dilemma that we're facing. And here's my take on globalization. Is it good or bad? I say it's been good for companies, for multinationals, because they can produce anywhere in the world the cheapest they can. Workers, their incomes, whether they lost their job or their incomes haven't advanced, they're facing more competition. The union movement ain't what it used to be. The ugly is income inequality. And let me just spend a second on that. If you look at the distribution between the richest and the poorest, and we're going to just do it by income levels, five income bands, the gap between rich and poor today is the widest since the 1920s. So it's gotten wider, and I think globalization's a factor. Two, then what we don't have is the mobility that we used to have. So, for example, let me give you. In the 1980s, oil prices skyrocketed. And what happened? People from Michigan said, you know what? I don't have a job here. I'm going to go to the South or Southwest and work in the energy space. So we had migration, and that seemed to work out. So today, what I'm concerned with is if you're outside of an urban area and you lost your plant, your retail store, or whatever, guess what? You feel trapped. You know, and I think that's part of the angst in our country. I contend if you're in a city today, you're probably doing reasonably well. If you're outside of a city or, you know, smaller business, that's right, you're hurting. And I think that's the challenge that we face as a nation.
The lady right behind you.
Right behind you, and then we'll come to you.
We'll go. You're next. Go ahead, please.
Okay, so
put it right to your mouth.
I'm referring back to the table that you had on the costs of medical care. And one of the things that I always am puzzled by here is the attribution of the major cost factors,
yes,
compared to Europe and Canada. Europe and Canada don't have the insurance industry issues that we have to deal with, but it's very rarely that I see insurance costs accounted for as a separate line item.
Right, okay.
We hear about the costs of doctors, but not so much about the insurance industry. And I think here at UVA and the other hospitals I know, where each clinic is now attached to its own separate insurance cost center, and that's added enormously to the costs, but we don't seem to want to talk about that.
You know, and that's a good point. By the way, truth in advertising, I work for an insurance company, but I'm clean because we do not do medical. We're just life and annuities, that sort of thing. But I think it's an interesting point because I haven't seen that breakdown either. So in general, you know, when you go and when I do read what are the major differentiators, I would say cost of drugs, pharma, to cost of hospitals. I'm not sure if it's cost of physician. It might have been more important in the past. And then I have not seen insurance. What I have seen is administrative costs are much higher in the U.S. system than elsewhere. So it's a fair point. I don't know the answer to your question.
Okay. There's two questions on this side, and then we've got another one on this side. So.
I'm invested in stocks and bonds, and I guess I was wondering, over time, have you come up with any strategy for handling the rising and falling economy in terms of getting out of stocks, be investing in stocks, et cetera?
Yeah. The answer is, of course, everybody tries to do that. I would say the thing I believe in is it is inherently difficult to time the market. And I certainly don't claim that I'm a better market timer than other people. So the only thing I can say to you, though, is what do you look at, though? Because I'll try to either add to positions, trim positions, or even take stronger action. So one of the things we do look at is valuation. Is the asset inherently expensive, or is it cheap, or is it reasonably priced? And I would say today in the stock market, there's a division of views. People who look at historic price earnings multiples say this market's expensive, get out. Okay. And but that's not the only measure of valuation. And there's, in fact, Jeremy Grantham from Grantham Mayo, who's been a bear a lot of his life, even he says, you know what, I'm forced to concede that something happened in the last two decades that price to earnings multiples for the last two decades are higher than the historic average. So they've continued for a long time. And when you go and you say, so what is it that makes the situation a little different? Number one, firms are better allocators of capital today than they used to be. In other words, if you're a business and, hey, times are better, well, let's spend on plant and equipment and everything. And then what they learned is they would do the spend at the wrong time. So I personally believe that whereas a lot of people say our problem is that we don't have enough business investment, I'm saying, yeah, but the businesses are earning record profits, so I'm not sure that that's a mistake. The other part of the argument is that we're living just in this world of record low interest rates. So, A, it makes bonds less attractive relative to stocks and the like. And so I think it's that. So I tend to fall more in the second category, that the market is not cheap. But I don't, and I've written the book on bubbles, I don't think this is a bubble. If you said to me, but can't we sell off 10, 15%? Of course. I'm saying that's the price of admission today. But that a 10 to 15 isn't what we went through when we went through -50, -50 in the, So I don't see that reoccurring. But pullback, yeah.
So thanks for your talk. You talked about the pessimist Robert Gordon. And he argues that we're looking, as you said, at a period where fundamentally annual growth is going to be more like 1 or 1.5% compared to the 3 or 4% because of demographics.
Yep.
And also because he claims that the productivity, which is the most important factor, spiked in the middle 20th century, and it ain't going to come back again.
Yes.
So, but what I wonder is, and you talked about tax policy and tax rates, and I know the mantra is, oh my gosh, if you lower taxes, you'll increase growth. Do you believe that? I remember reading a paper from CBO that plotted annual growth rates on the y-axis versus the maximum tax rates on the x-axis, and there was no correlation at all.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Now, there are lots of other things going on, but what do you think?
I think you're asking a great question. I would say the following, because here again, in the great political divide, okay, between Republicans and Democrats, here's how I see things. Paul Ryan worships, and I mean religiously, in the belief that lowering the corporate tax rate will spur investment activity, will be good for workers. You could give him a truth serum. This is what he truly believes. It's religion. What I basically say in my book is I've tried to look at the empirical studies, and there's nothing conclusive. And so where I come out is, I'm not an atheist, what do you call it? I'm basically an agnostic. But what I'm willing to do, here's my thought. The Democrats had 8 years to try to jumpstart things, and they did it initially with fiscal stimulus and then get interest rates artificially low. And now that's why I say with Larry Summers, who's a brilliant man, he's trying to tell me, but they haven't gone low enough. I'm going, you got to be kidding.
This. Everybody also wants infrastructure.
Yes, yes. No, no, and that's the part I do agree with. But I'm saying, though, this commitment to lower and lower and lower and lower interest rates, we've run as far as we can go. So where I come out is I'm willing to say, let's let the Republicans try their thing on the corporate side, and we'll see. So I'm open-minded, but I'm not sitting here about to tell you I'm a fervent believer. And I'd close with one other comment. I do believe people are underestimating the impact of less regulatory burden. Because I have looked at studies. And one of the studies is who gets hit the hardest by regulations? Smaller businesses. Why do they get hit? Because the big guys can dodge taxes, but the small guys, they got to do this paperwork up the wazoo. And so let's lighten their regulatory burden. I have sympathy for that. But again, if you said to me, quantify the effect, I can't do that. But I think it's a good idea.
This is your fault because you left that chart up. In this country, in terms of deaths of newborn children, we're 17th. In this country,
we are
17th in terms of deaths to newborn children.
Right.
We are 41st in terms of longevity.
Yeah.
Richest country in the world. But there are 16 countries that have shown up there that average a cost of 10% versus our 17%. What are they doing right? Is anybody studying their system?
Oh, and the answer is yes. There have been a lot of studies of comparisons. I tried to be honest with you, I tried to get into it, and after a while, it overwhelms you because when I wrote this chapter in my book, I'm basically saying I know nothing. And so I wasn't coming here to pretend I'm the expert. What I'm trying to do is say, I didn't know very much. Here's what I learned. I'm sharing it with you. And then there's other good questions follow up. But obviously that is one of the questions is, what are the others doing right? The other thing I do want to say in defense of the U.S. system, there's one argument in defense of it is, you're no longer a prince in Saudi Arabia because you're probably in jail. But you're a very wealthy person, and you care about getting the best health care in the world. Where do you go? Here. So the argument that is, if there's one thing where we do stand out on the positive, it's if you need the most complex procedures known to mankind, we're still the best at that. But, that's great for sheiks and everybody. But, if what you're saying is, but what about the average Joe? And unfortunately, we're just a lot more expensive.
Fit into your scheme what I consider the radical defunding of education in this country, especially higher education. Not only are we placing this huge burden on young people, which prevents them from even having a decent credit rating. They are not going to be the productive individuals and big spenders that are needed to carry the burden for those of us who are going into the sunset, let alone having lives of their own. I think it's a real cries to heaven for change. We're wasting generations of people.
Right. And on that, we're soulmates. Basically, if you come to, I think one of the messages of the book for me is there aren't many quick fixes out there. And that's why the issues are complex and they can be heated. But if we go to Robert Gordon, or you go to others and say, what's the best thing I can do to, you know, either assure over the long term improved productivity or to help to narrow the gap between the haves and the have-nots? It would be to improve the ability of people to attain more education and to obtain better education. So if you elect me, I will be the education president. Again, you and I may be the only two people voting for me, but I believe it. And you know that is, and it's, you were saying philanthropic. I'll tell you the one foundation that I've really found in Cincinnati, Ohio. There's at the University of Cincinnati, they have a Center for Economic Education, and what they do is they go into the inner city and take kids in grammar school. They're not teaching them to be junior economists. So I said to the head of the program, what are you teaching them? They're teaching them good decision-making skills. So they may have to run, you know, like a program of, you know, supplies and stuff like that. And they're junior businessmen, but they're learning decision-making. So I said to her, I said, okay, convince me you make a difference. So she said, okay, there's a fourth grader in one of the programs. She said, what did you learn from taking this class? And he said, I learned I don't want to be a member of a gang. You can have my money. I will. That's what I want to fund, is if we can make a difference in many areas. But it's hard.
You and I talked shortly about the Chinese-U.S. Yeah. relationship at dinner, lunch. And I didn't get a chance to ask you this. And it's a major concern of mine as a patriot. I feel like we're being left in the dust in regards to our development of and attention toward one of the larger continents in our world, and that's Africa. And I feel like the Chinese are leaving us in the dust in regards to global economics, in regards to their human and natural resources.
Yes.
And I'd like a comment on what, how do you think that if we don't concern ourselves more about it and focus on it more, how will that affect our economy?
Okay. That's an interesting question. What I would basically say is, the way I think about it is, U.S. is an advanced economy but also a resource-rich economy. Therefore, we're not going to be as involved in Africa. China is a rapidly growing industrial economy, needs access to cheap raw materials. So it's inevitable then that, you know, they've gone in that sphere. So that part of the equation, I just say, that kind of makes sense to me, that division of labor. The thing that where I'm torn a bit on is, again, job losses and the like. Really, when we started seeing job losses related to trade, it was more a 2000s phenomena. And I think you could tie a lot of those losses to China and other emerging Asian economies. Okay, what were they doing? Very simply, they were going out. They had their central banks or their sovereign wealth funds buying dollars, selling their currencies to pay for it. What was that doing? That was giving them an inherent competitive advantage because they had a cheap currency and they're keeping our currency artificially stronger. So I just got back from a conference, and in all honesty, I didn't understand fully the magnitude of that had gone on in the way of this currency intervention. So now the next question is, so what do we do about it? Well, Donald Trump says, before he took office, I'm going to declare China a currency manipulator. Well, he hasn't. And you say, well, why hasn't he? Well, we need him for North Korea. So he's going to hold off. But the other fact is China had been a currency manipulator until about 2015. They stopped doing it. So what I see now is, I mean, here's my debate. You know, you can go after these sexual predators for indiscretions they committed in the past. I mean, do we go after the Chinese today and say, we let you guys get away with cheating on us 10 years ago, and now we're going to say, you know, compensate us? I mean, that's the problem I see right now, is I think there is valid concern about currency manipulation. The trouble I have is, what do I do now if they're not manipulating their currency now? So that's been my issue, more so than, and again, like, do they cheat in terms of tech? You know, they want U.S. companies to come in so they can take our technology, and we seem to be willing to do so. And so I do think we have to really crack down. You know, in other words, we have to be a lot tougher. That's the one part I will say. Donald, sometimes, you know, he's all over the map, but I think you have to be a tougher negotiator with the Chinese than we have been.
I actually have two things. One's a comment, sort of, and the other's a question. The comment is, have you ever seen on YouTube a presentation called Shift Happens, S-H-I-F-T? Oh. If you haven't, you may want to, because it goes into innovation and the changes that are occurring. It was written in, like, originally in 2005. This has been updated to continue the conversation. I do hardly recommend it. One of my bosses, when I was working in the government, had all of us look at it. But the second thing is, I keep seeing healthcare system. Within the U.S., we have five different healthcare systems.
Yes.
And when you say healthcare system, how are you counting that? Only for the insurance side, or are you doing it for the military, which is a single payer, single provider, or the VA the same way, or Medicare, which is a single payer, multi-provider, or what?
Right.
Because they're very different
in
their outlooks, and they're very different in the care that they provide, which I think people don't understand.
Right.
And and to me, I question our former representative, because before the ACA came in, I asked him whether, or before it went into effect, I asked him whether he was using the civil service medical.
Okay.
And he wouldn't tell me.
Yeah.
And the reason I was asking him was because that is a federally run exchange where we as citizens pay three quarters of the of the premium. So I was curious on that for obvious reason.
You know, now, what, that is a very good question. Because, so to be clear again, this, Nick is the novice. This is, you know, this is new to me. So what I did was, I simply took the data out of this, it's a source so you can compare, quote, systems across, you know, major advanced economies. My impression is that they were trying to be as comprehensive as possible. But you're, you know, you rightly point out, we got multiple systems. So are some being included and others being excluded? Possibly. But I believe that, I mean, the intent of this was to be comprehensive. So I'm glad you asked the question, because now I've got to go back to my data source and see exactly how they defined it. This is a good audience.
This is a perfect time.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank
this has been fantastic.
Thank you.